This is Allison Letary, author of Standout Startup, the founder's guide to irresistible marketing that fuels growth, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Allison Letary to talk about her book, Standout Startup, The Founder's Guide to Irresistible Marketing That Fuels Growth, published by Costa Flora. Allison Letary is a marketing leader and startup advisor who helps tech startups launch winning go-to-market strategies. She's built marketing teams from scratch to scale at fast-growing tech companies in Silicon Valley like Handshake, Thumbtack, and Intuit. Allison now works with founders and venture capitalists to accelerate their startups' growth. Allison holds an MBA from the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And a BA from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And, interesting fact, she has been a repeat guest on NBC's Today Show. Allison, congratulations on Standout Startup, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Wow, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. Glad to be here.
So you got your MBA from Stanford, and longtime listeners will know that for some mysterious reason, there have been more authors on the show with Stanford degrees than any other university, by an order of magnitude. I mean, is it like a requirement to be admitted to if you promise to write a book later on?
Ooh, that's a great fact. I don't know, but I do think you get the entrepreneurial bug there, and writing a book is definitely an entrepreneurial venture, so it's probably in our DNA in some way.
Well, I don't know, but by Marketing Book Podcast law, I am now required to play the Stanford fight song whenever I interview one of their grads. But Allison Letary, more importantly, I've interviewed almost 350 authors for the Marketing Book Podcast, and you are the first author who is a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I've interviewed three Duke grads, and finally, this is a Chapel Hill person.
Oh, I'm so proud. And honestly, that music takes me back. You just gave me chills. So
yes.
Thanks for playing that.
Yes. Well, two of my uncles went to Chapel Hill. Oh. And one of them, he told me his resident advisor, I think they call them RAs, which for folks not familiar, it's like the senior student in charge of a dormitory, was Andy Griffith.
Oh, yes. He is a notable alum.
Yeah, the late actor. And it's funny because he was there, and he was just a student who was studying music, and he gathered all the guys on the steps of the dorm and said, okay, my name's Andy Griffith. I'm your RA. I'm going to give you a briefing, but first let me ask you a question. Which of you have tuxedos? And my uncle and a few other guys raised their hand, and he said, okay, you're all in the glee club now. There was no audition at all. So it's a funny story. And then both my uncles were in fraternities at Chapel Hill, and that seemed to have formed, you know, the life they lived later on. But my cousin also went to Chapel Hill, and Michael Jordan sat behind her in French literature class.
Because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
So she's like, you know, Chapel Hill royalty. But even more important than all that, Allison Letary was born in Asheville, North Carolina, right?
Yes, I was.
Which is where my mother, Antoinette Burdett, was from, Asheville.
Oh,
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I love these connections. Thank you.
Well, and not long after she graduated from Duke University, I know you're wincing.
Oh boy.
She was the rhododendron queen in Asheville, North Carolina. So do you know what that means, Allison?
Well, I know what rhododendrons are, but I'm not sure about the queen part.
Well, it means I'm royalty, Allison.
Obviously.
Yeah. Thank you. So, which actually doesn't mean much at all to my fellow Americans, except maybe Meghan Markle. But the next time I'm in England, meeting with Marketing Book podcast listeners, I want my props.
Respect.
So I mentioned that my mom graduated from Duke, and you're being very nice. And I just wanted you to know that when she was in her 80s, and she and one of her brothers who went to Chapel Hill, as I mentioned, they passed away within 6 weeks of each other. And right up until the very end, her brother was giving her shit about going to Duke.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely necessary. And I do feel a little outnumbered in San Francisco, but very proud graduate, and it got me off on a great path in life.
Well, great. That's great. So anyway, I'm celebrating that I finally have a Chapel Hill graduate on the show. Maybe I can stop now, and I got to get two more to balance it out, because I know how competitive you all are. And even one of my brothers went to Duke, and naturally he was my mother's favorite child, and I can respect that, but I just know how competitive they all are. So it's, oh boy. Anyway, enough about all that. Let's talk about your book. It is exceptionally well-written and organized, and whenever I am asked for a book recommendation on marketing for a startup, I will definitely be recommending your book for a long time. And I get, and I hear from a lot of folks, and I already know, I already got quite a reaction from a lot of listeners who were excited to know that I was going to be interviewing you. And I get pitched a lot of books about, you know, entrepreneurship, or how to be an entrepreneur, or how to run a startup. And I usually always pass on those because I want to stick to marketing or sales related to a startup. So your book is a great fit. And there are a few other books that have been on the show related to the startup world and marketing, which I will include links to on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. Those are other authors, some of which have Stanford degrees. Weird. Who wrote books that are a nice complement to yours. So folks could go check those out. And also, you have a lot of really helpful grids and things about, you know, how to map things out. And all of it is included in the toolkit at your website. And I'm going to include a link to that to make it easy for everybody. But tell us about all the things that are in the toolkit on your website.
Wonderful. Well, first, thank you so much for that incredible feedback. And it was a pleasure to write this book. And really, the toolkit comes out of the step-by-step process that I outline through the pages of Standout Startup to help any founder or startup leader without a marketing background go through the steps to create effective messaging and content. So you'll see a great template for creating your ICP, ideal customer profile and persona, positioning worksheets, some amazing content on how to create an effective brand personality, and then you'll see templates for creating effective messaging and how to plan out your content strategy and calendar for the year. So I would definitely encourage everyone who reads the book, and even if you don't, to download the toolkit to get a fast start in these processes.
Until the book arrives. So now there's a dirty little secret about your book, Allison, and that is that everything in here applies to non-startups. I'm sorry.
<Yes.
laughs> This is very helpful for startups. Oh, don't I? All the ones that I've known, have worked with, talked to, but this also applies to big businesses and small businesses, old businesses. There are just way too many companies that are not doing the basic things that you have here that are so smart. And as I've mentioned in some other podcasts recently, if you are a listener and not working for a startup and think that what we're going to talk about here does not really apply to you, you know, it doesn't apply to other businesses or organizations, and you think you're not going to learn anything new in this conversation,
idiot,
you are going to miss out, because the truth is that everything in this book is relevant to the companies that aren't getting it right. So the book is divided into three sections, which is define your three P's to unlock messaging, which we're going to talk about. And then the second part is about developing powerful product messaging. And the third part is about creating a content strategy that drives growth. So I want to read a couple of things from the very beginning of the book, actually on page one. You've launched an innovative product that will change your customers' lives for the better, but now you need great product messaging. Without it, getting traction with customers is going to be slow or even impossible. You probably already know this. I've worked with many tech startup founders who, after we start to dig into their marketing strategy and goals, say it's a challenge to get their ideal customers interested in their product. They need to know how to make their startup's product stand out to unlock user growth. Effective product messaging is the backbone of a successful marketing strategy. No matter how well your product delivers results, if you can't explain who it's for, what it does, and why it's better than the alternatives, you won't attract and retain customers. I'm losing potential customers every day because our messaging is wrong, the co-founder of a Series A climate tech startup told me in frustration. My business development team doesn't know how to explain the value of our product. Their pitch is all wrong, and I'm overwhelmed trying to fix it. Her company's growth had stalled, and the team needed a way to explain to prospects why their product was a better choice than legacy solutions. Another founder winced as he shared, "Our target audience just doesn't get it." His seed stage fintech startup was struggling to grow app downloads. Our product is clearly superior to everything else in the market, but something about how we're describing the app just isn't connecting. Choosing us should be a no-brainer for people who want the best financial returns, but they're not signing up. And then further down on that page, you're right. It's no surprise that when founders sense that their messaging is weak, they feel like the rest of their marketing is confusing or chaotic. They also don't know what content to create because they're not sure what their ideal customers need to know to buy and engage with their product. Founders can feel paralyzed, especially if they don't have a marketing team yet to figure all this out. But here's the good news. There's a clear process you can use to get unstuck. Create powerful product messaging and develop content that drives growth. And it doesn't require you to be a marketer. That's exactly what you'll learn how to do with this book. This guide reveals how to make your startup stand out and use marketing to engage your ideal customers. And finally, at the bottom of page three, you write, the work that goes into developing personas, positioning, brand personality, and messaging, all of which you'll learn how to do in this book, is so core to a startup's product and growth strategy that it's a miss to consider it simply marketing work. It's some of the most strategic work a startup founder and their team can do to get traction. And yet, Allison, why does the work that is so core to a startup's product and growth strategy get short shrift so often?
It's a great question. I think many times technical founders, who is the group of people that I'm working with most often, really have no frame in their mind for what marketing encompasses or where they can dive in. And so while they might be doing founder-led sales or having conversations with customers, they're not connecting the dots that every day they're trying to figure out the most effective way to describe their product. But many times their website isn't describing it in that way, their team isn't aligned on these messages, and the content that they're creating is kind of all over the place. And so they're not aware of the fact that if they just did some of the foundational marketing strategy work, they could align the team and they could make all of their customer-facing touch points so much clearer and more powerful, saying the same clear, critical messages.
Mm. Well, before we talk about the three P's that I mentioned, which are personas, positioning, and personality, I want you to talk about what's on page 18, the overarching mindsets that are so necessary for successful startup marketing. I couldn't agree more. These are like a North Star, regardless of exactly which tactics you ultimately end up using.
Yes. So I mentioned three mindsets. The first is create value for customers. And really, as you're thinking about any of the decisions you're making in marketing or any of the content you're putting out in the world, the question you should ask yourself is, do my customers need to know this? Is this useful and valuable? And will this move them forward in their decision-making process? Will it make them like our product more and prefer our product more? And if it's not valuable to them, if it's ancillary or something that your product or your company wants to announce but actually has nothing to do with the customer, then it really should go on the chopping block. It's just not something your customers need to know about. So that's the first. The second is embracing an iterative process. And so this is so important and why one of the main reasons I wanted to write the book, because it's so useful to learn this process of creating effective messaging and then a content strategy that supports it, because you will go through this many times over the course of your business. As your product roadmap rolls out and you release new features, as new competitors enter the market and suddenly the things that differentiated you before are no longer as powerful because they're copying you or there's something very unique about them. And also as customer needs shift or you want to enter a new segment of customers, you need to be able to figure out how to message and position your product in a way that cuts through. So it's iterative. Don't try to get things perfect right now. Really try to get the messages to be as strong as they can be and test and see what engages.
And related to don't try and be perfect. Yeah, you're going to go to the third one here. A bias towards action. I love it.
The third one's so important, and it's probably one of the biggest lessons I've taken away from working inside startups. Have that bias towards action. It does not help you, and you don't learn anything from looking at the screen and tweaking messages over and over. You need to get out there and talk to customers and get their feedback on what you're saying and see when their eyes light up and they make a decision to move forward, or when something shuts down a conversation and you realize that that messaging isn't as strong. And also, you want to get things out in on your website and ads and social media to see what drives engagement and clicks, because that's where the useful data comes from and the insights. And I can see companies getting really stuck because they're afraid to change anything because it's not perfect. But I guarantee it's better than what's confusing and watered down on your website today.
Oh, that's great. So create value for customers. That's even in a sales call your sales team might be making. Is this of any value to them at all? Are we being helpful in the least bit? And just talking about your own product is not helpful. If that's all you're talking about, embrace the iterative process. Marketing is not a fire and forget missile. It's not a one and done thing. It's a process, not a destination. And the bias towards action, you know, it's like no decision is a decision. just make a decision, move forward, and learn. You know, there's been other books on the show that talk about how certain companies will make it more safe to take action by saying, okay, this is going to be a test. What are we going to learn? You know, things like that. So I want to read from, the beginning of chapter 2. I love this. You write, Sophia, the founder of a security software platform that detects risks for e-commerce companies, asked me to review her startup's website. The website was freshly redesigned and it was beautiful, full of inspiring graphics, modern fonts, logos from top VC investors, and detailed description of their product features. From their homepage, I was able to download a report that validated the merits of their product's approach to monitoring security threats. But there was a clear messaging gap. Allison, what was the gap?
Well, the gap is something that I see all too often, which is a company's website is either a product brochure that's talking about the features and the functionality, but it's missing the opportunity to talk to the customer about, we understand the challenges you have, and our product will deliver this big outcome, and then use the features as a proof point that shows they can actually deliver that benefit. But that's not the main story. Or in other cases, I see companies really describe their origin story or what their company is all about doing in the world, but they don't relate it to the customer's specific need. And so they might have nice logos from investors and show the great picture of their founder. But again, someone coming to the website that is their ideal customer would not at a glance know, this is for me. This is solving a big problem that I have, and then quickly understand how this is better than the other solutions they might be considering.
Yes, it's like they don't feel like they're understood, or they look at the website and they might, and if it is good, they're going to say, God, these people, I think they might understand me. I feel like I'm home. This is more about me and my problems. You mentioned customer profile, ICP, ideal customer profile, you know, as a starting point. Talk about the things that should be in an ICP, because that might right off the bat get folks thinking more about their customer than themselves.
Yes. So an ICP is really critical if you are a B2B company. So if you're selling to other businesses, really getting clear on who is the best fit business for our product. What types of companies will get the best outcomes if they choose our solution? And so knowing the firmographics, what are some of the typical characteristics of that company? Industry, size, number of employees, revenue, those types of things tend to help you narrow the set of companies that you're focused on. But many times the technographics are actually even more important to understand. So what are the types of solutions they're already using? What's their tech stack? What are some of the software solutions that they already have? And how might we fit really well into that ecosystem? Or when are those companies very unlikely to adopt us because they're using something that's not super compatible or where we don't fit in? Mm-hmm. And then really narrowing down to, okay, what are the key pain points that the company's facing when they need a solution like ours? And what's the outcomes? What's the gain that they want to experience once they change that? When you are thinking about B2B, there are specific people on the buying committee within that company, and you need to develop personas and really get into each of their minds. But the starting point is, what does this company look like? And then you can start to figure out who to talk to within that company.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned shifts, which I think is so important to zero in on. That's the changes or events that make the company open to finding a solution.
That's exactly right. Shifts are so critical because when someone is actually open to considering your product, you need to understand what's happening. So in companies, this might be they've hit a certain growth milestone and certain processes are breaking, or they're having vulnerabilities that they never experienced before. Or sometimes an internal leadership change is the perfect time to go in and start selling because they might be more open to a new solution. So really understanding the context of what's happening when someone becomes open to a product like ours and in market can help you tailor content to that moment versus a more generic story about what that company might be facing.
Oh, so true. Well, let's talk about personas. It's, you know, like so many things we're going to talk about, it's something that everyone may have heard of and they think they may not be completely clear on what it is or what it isn't. Explain what a persona is for the newly initiated, and what are the most important factors in the development of a persona as you describe in your book?
Yes. A persona is really a summary of your ideal customer and the information you need to know about them to craft messages that cut through. So the starting point, there are five key factors. Mm-hmm. The first is pains. What are the key problems someone's trying to solve or challenges? And they might not even know they have those challenges, but things that they need to overcome with a solution like yours.
Right. And these could be emotional pains.
Yes, it's really important to think beyond just functional pains. What are mm-hmm. the jobs to be done? What do I need this product to accomplish? And think about what friction is this causing in someone's life because they can't get those jobs done? Mm-hmm. Extra stress, insecurity, fear, sadness, understanding those emotions that they want to improve or overcome really plays into your messaging. And then you also don't want to forget about the social pain points. So really thinking about how is not having a solution hurting the perception of this person in their organization or in their life or impacting their relationships, because sometimes it's causing strain or concern. So really getting a full profile of that person's needs related to the challenge that you can solve will help you create much stronger messaging.
And just to interject for the listener, not once did we talk about the product.
No. Yeah. Great point.
So beyond pains, you got it. Yeah, you mentioned there were five. The next one is gains.
The next one is gains. And again, thinking, what are the jobs to be done, those mm-hmm. functional outcomes, but also how does someone want to feel once they have this solution in their life? The sense of ease, happiness, connection, status. Maybe mm-hmm. this will make them look more effective at work. And so identifying those functional, social, and emotional gains, what are those big outcomes? And really, good messaging is about showing someone that you can take them out of the pain and into the gain. These are the outcomes you can deliver. And then backing it up with your differentiators. How do you do that in a better way than the alternatives? And proving that people are actually experiencing that outcome once they get to your product. So pains and gains are essential factors in the persona. And then we mentioned shifts before. So again, what's happening in someone's life that makes them open to a new solution? Or as you're thinking about content strategy, sometimes people don't really understand their pains and they're not completely problem aware. So really getting insights into what do they need to know or believe to start to become more interested in products like ours. Mm-hmm. So that can really shape messaging and content. And then the last two factors are understanding blockers. So even when someone understands they're using a suboptimal solution or they're in pain, many times things will hold them back from taking action or choosing a better product. And so what are those key blockers, whether they're financial or emotional or an influencer in their life is telling them they should do something different? So identifying the blockers and then thinking about the motivators that can move them forward and take them out of that objection. And sometimes this is just better understanding your product's features or their user experience. Many times motivators are things like social proof and endorsements from trusted external parties. And sometimes it's just data and information. But when you start your messaging process with these personas, already you have a really strong sense of how could I describe my product in a way that would feel very valuable to this person? And that might be a very different way than you would describe your product to someone else who's in a different persona and has very different pains, gains, shifts, et cetera.
Right. So it's pains, gains, shift, blockers, and motivators. Oh, I love the way you frame that. So, and also, it's not like we're talking about, you know, men 18 to 45. This applies to a much broader audience, and it's much more helpful. That's the thing I love about buyer personas. I mean, the other one is more of a harkens back to my days as an ad man, where you know we were buying media a certain way. But I think there's still too many companies thinking, oh, this is a product for, you know, describing them demographically, and that's just I just don't find it very helpful. So let's jump to competition. I want to quote page 45. You write, your persona is your go-to guide for what your ideal customer values. That means you now have the keys to explain your product in terms that resonate with your ideal customer's needs. But what makes your product more valuable and attractive than the other solutions your ideal customer could choose? So talk about how most efficiently to learn more about that. Because I think there's a lot of information out there on what you think might be the competition, but a lot of it still may not be terribly helpful.
That's right. And really, if I could help companies do just one thing better, in many cases, it would be have more conviction around why your product is different and better, and mm-hmm. make sure that's really shining through in your materials, because it can be, it's sometimes really surprising to me that companies make customers work really hard to suss out why they should choose you over the others. Mm-hmm. And to come up with your positioning and figure out your differentiators, I really encourage companies to start with a competitive map. And this requires getting clear on the solutions that your ideal customer that you capture in your persona will be evaluating you against. And sometimes this is direct competitors, right? The other companies that look a lot like yours. But many times this is a set of indirect competitors that solve part of the needs of what your product solves, but they might be stitching together a couple different solutions to come up with the overall outcome they need. Or it could be something DIY, like many companies are evaluating whether to build something in-house on their own or adopt a solution. And then we also see that do nothing can be a strong competitor, right?
It's probably just the number one, yeah.
Yes, just continue to eke it out the way I've always been doing it, or with small businesses, pen and paper. There are so many different ways to just get by with the current solution. So once you have the set of competitors that you know your ideal customers will be evaluating you against, then you need to start to think about what are those key attributes that the customer is thinking through as they're choosing one solution over the other. And where do our competitors spike? Like, what are the things that are really attracting our ideal customers to each of those products? And then what makes us stand out? What are the reasons that our best customers choose us and decide not to go with the alternatives?
Yes, and one of the most important things in this chapter, or one of the many things that people should remember, is that you have more competitors than you realize. And as we mentioned, one of them is do nothing. People will live with pain much longer than we realize. And there was another book on the show a while back called The Jolt Effect that talked about just how frightened people are at making any kind of decision. But also, with a lot of companies, they're very familiar, I found, with companies who are just like them, direct competitors, and they focus on them too much. Whereas the customer may not really understand the differences, and there are things that are what you call indirect competitors that I found companies will kind of sniff at and say, oh, no, they couldn't do it. Well, maybe not, but your customer thinks they could. So you need to address that.
Absolutely. Many times you'll see a company website really focused on their somewhat myopic view of the world, right? The companies that look just like them. But what your customer is actually thinking about is, am I going to switch from this more manual solution or this other way of doing things that's only solving part of my needs, but maybe I don't need the full solution? And so to get to messaging that really overcomes that, you have to address the set of indirect competitors or the status quo and not solely focus on other tech platform type products that look like yours or whatever industry you're in.
Oh, such great advice.
Let's talk about something important.
Okay, listeners, you know what's coming. I'm going to quote from page 58, and this is information that will make you a successful marketer, a successful salesperson. It'll help you gain an unfair advantage. There's no substitute for talking directly to a set of your ideal customers to refine your persona and understanding of your top competitors.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Allison Letary, why is there such hesitation for companies to not talk to their customers?
What a great question. And this cuts across marketing and even product development too. But sometimes what is the most obvious next step seems really challenging. And I would say if you're in a sales-driven organization, in some ways you're at an advantage because your sales team is talking to customers or prospects, hopefully every day. And so you have a really easy opportunity for them to quickly change up some of the things they're talking about in their conversation or use a new sales aid, a new one-pager with slightly different messaging to see if that's cutting through or what reactions that's getting. But even without a sales team, reaching out and recruiting a subset of your current customers and a subset of prospects who fit your persona and asking them questions about their needs and the outcomes they desire and what's suboptimal about their current solutions and what are things they'd like to have done better will give you so much insight to create your persona. But then once you have your messages, showing some alternatives and getting quick feedback is a really helpful first step so that you can make some refinements before you start to put things out through your different channels and get more data-driven engagement tests running.
Yeah, this is the, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills part because of the over 450 books that have been on the show. The one thread that keeps coming through is that if companies would just go talk to their customers, they'll do better. You know, and you don't have to do it perfectly. You just have to understand them a little bit better than your competition. And it just seems like such a blind spot. And I had a author on recently, Scott Ettinger, and he was in his new book, he was talking about I believe it was a tech company in your area, and the CEO they were flatline. Oh, it was Pete's Coffee, and there was a certain amount of sales stalling, And the marketing people had done all this work, and the CEO said, what did the customers have to say about this? And it turned out the marketing folks hadn't spoken to a single customer about any of this. So if CEOs could just ask that one question, like, when was the last time you talked to a customer? What kind of program do you have to talk to these people? And it doesn't mean sitting down and saying, what do you want? Let's go back to what you already talked about. Pains, gains, shift, blockers, motivators. So anyway, I'm sorry. I know this is turning into a support group. So talk about some of the other ways to do some research besides having insightful conversations with customers. You mentioned sales team as well. That was one.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I really appreciate that you pointed out having customer conversations doesn't just give you insight about the customer themselves. It also gives you a lot of insight about the competitive landscape and helps you narrow down to that set of competitors that you should be focusing on. And what is so special and attractive about each of those in the eyes of your ideal customer. So that's a great place to start. Some other great places, really just going onto your competitors' websites and trying to dissect what they're saying is their unique selling proposition. What's their big promise and how do they explain who they're for and the outcome that they're delivering? And then what are the top three benefits that they're sharing through their website and really emphasizing? Because that gives you some understanding of what they think is helping them stand out and is really special and attractive in the eyes of their customers. So just some external competitive research can also get you far. We talked about sales team research and listening, but also talking to your customer support team.
Yes.
And better understanding what are some of the key things that people are loving about our product and where are they having the most trouble and what competitors are they talking about or pain points that they feel like are still unmet. So that can be a really rich source of information. And then the one other thing I'll mention is even just social listening. So looking through your own comments in any of the social media that you're putting into the world, but also looking at competitors, and you'll see a lot from where customers tend to engage on the things they love and the things they hate. So you'll probably get a quick sense for what are people raving about with our competitors' products and what's giving them that edge. And what are things that they're complaining about and what are gaps that we could potentially position ourselves as filling or doing really well?
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned keyword research, which a lot of folks seem to forget. But also you mentioned surveys. And I would say, yep, surveys are great, but I wouldn't do those first. Talk to the customers first.
Yes.
Surveys can help you, but later on. So the unacceptable answer to the CEO is, well, no, we didn't talk to any customers, but we did a survey. Wrong answer. So you have a chapter on defining your positioning, and I'd like to zero in on a section that fascinated me about flipping the matrix to shift perceptions. And if you would, explain what flipping the matrix is and talk about some of the techniques that help you flip the matrix to create smart positioning.
Yes. Well, so many times when a company needs to create new messaging, really what they're trying to do is shift the perception of their product in the minds of their ideal customers. Mm-hmm. So that might be creating a perception at all if customers haven't heard about your product and you are an early stage startup. But I also work with a lot of companies that feel like we used to be really strong in one area, but now we're offering so many more things and customers still think of us in this one way. So we need to shift how they think about our product. Or competitors are entering, again, copycats or competitors that are positioning themselves in a certain way. And the company needs to find a way to stand out and be better against those alternatives. So flipping the matrix really starts with thinking about a positioning matrix. So just a simple 2x2 and thinking about when customers are choosing our competitors, what are the things they're optimizing for? Why are they finding those other solutions really attractive? And when you use that as a starting point, your competitors will be in the upper right quadrant, right? They're knocking it out of the park on those two attributes. But many times, you know that your product is actually a better choice for a certain set of customers because they should be optimizing for other criteria. And so flipping the matrix is thinking about what are those two attributes that put us in the upper right quadrant, and our competitors fall behind because they're not offering those benefits or that experience in as strong a way as we are. So I do mention four different techniques that I see really help startups think about positioning. Mm-hmm. One is this new frame. So really thinking about what are these two attributes that we should emphasize because we know that our ideal customers will get a better outcome if they optimize for those and choose our product. But another really powerful one is just choosing an opposite attribute. So your competitor stands for this. We stand for this opposite thing, mm-hmm. which is actually better and more valuable for our ideal customers. And this was one of the key techniques we used at Handshake, where LinkedIn really stands for mid-career professionals with a network. Handshake really stands for early career college students or early career professionals who have no network, and no network is required. So that creates really nice, healthy contrast to show who each of those job platforms is for.
It's more helpful to your customers than I think a lot of people realize.
Yes, completely agree. Because again, dialing up this contrast, and it needs to be attractive. Again, what is making it really exciting and wonderful for your customers to come to you. But the more contrast you can create, the easier it is for a customer to make a decision or understand why they should be drawn to your product versus the others.
Mm-hmm. And the others were future cast and specific segment, which we don't have to go into. But Allison, don't you really just need to say, we're going to be the Uber of blank?
Well, I think that's overused, unfortunately, which is why really thinking about, okay, what do our ideal customers need? We created this product for a reason. We have conviction around why our solution does things better than the others. And so how can we make that very clear in a way that's appealing to our customers and helps them understand that it's different from what the other products out there are doing.
Right, right. So the third P, as I mentioned, is about personality, which probably sounds kind of, you know, soft and squishy to some of these tech engineers, startup people. But let's see, page 87, you write about brand personality includes three main components. And they are, let me just mention what they are, brand attributes, which are the unique qualities and character of your brand. And the second is tone of voice, how your brand communicates through words, both written and spoken. And the third one is visual brand identity, the visual elements of your brand, logo, fonts, colors, icons, imagery. I'm worried that a lot of people, that's the only thing that comes to mind. Do you find that the first two, the brand attributes and tone of voice, are less understood in your world than the visual brand identity? How do they all fall out?
I do. So the reason I included this in the three P's is I kept finding as I was working with startup leaders that even if we understood their ideal customer and we had clear positioning, so we knew what messages we wanted to emphasize, without a clear personality, it was really hard to know exactly what words to use and how to come across through our tone. And I do think many companies create a visual brand identity in the beginning because there's some understanding that you need a consistent color palette and set of fonts across your website and your collateral and in your product. But they're less intentional about what is the consistent way I want to communicate that helps emphasize our differentiators and really helps us build a connection with our customers. And I really love brand archetypes, which I cover in the book too. Mm-hmm. Because they're a nice shortcut to helping you try on different ways you could communicate with your customers and see which one you think will resonate with them the most. So, for instance, are you more of the helper and caretaker? You're supporting, you're encouraging, you're really helping someone believe in themselves so that they can get a great outcome. Or is your product more of the hero, someone mm-hmm. who's going to come in and solve a really thorny problem so you don't have to worry about it ever again? And getting choosing a tone, choosing a set of brand attributes that define the way you're communicating will mean that you can actually look across your touch points and say, hey, are we being consistent in the way we talk so that we're creating a similar emotion and expectation every time we're communicating with our customers?
The one that you just mentioned, the brand archetype, I think, were you describing the ruler in that instance?
The ruler is another really helpful one, and actually one that I see tech startups really right. like using. Essentially, like, we're going to take control. We're going to be steady and consistent, and you are not going to have to worry about these painful security issues or whatever else is happening in your business again.
Yeah, there's 12 of them. There are 12 of them on here. Of course, I lied it up to the one that's called the Jester. Probably not a lot of those in the startup world, but it was interesting. It's a big chart. It's a great chart. And then this goes for several pages. And yet this brand attributes worksheet, this is solid gold. This is really, really helpful. And it's all in the toolkit. So as I mentioned, the second part of the book is about developing powerful product messaging. So again, another term that's thrown around a lot, What is your definition of a value proposition, or what is it you want people to really understand about what a value proposition is, and what are some of the main components that need to go into it?
A value proposition is a benefit or an outcome that your product delivers, and it really helps you explain why someone should choose your product. What is the value it's generating? And ideally, you want your value propositions to be differentiated as well. Because it's not a great thing if you see your website and then you could literally just swap out a competitor's name for your product name and your value propositions would apply to them too. That doesn't really help your customers with decision making. Mm-hmm. So as you think about value propositions, it's critical that you've done your persona positioning and personality work first, because that gives you a strong sense for the top messages you need to emphasize and the way you should say them. And I do include a checklist of things that value propositions should cover to mm-hmm. be really effective. And actually, one other thing I'll mention, I like to think of value propositions as three legs of a stool holding up your headline description of your product. So we are a what for who that delivers what outcome. That's your unique selling proposition, the headline statement about your product. But then you want three value propositions that really show comprehensively what your product does and why it's different and better. And when you have those three memorable messages, your customers should be able to pretty quickly get your head around what your product is, why it's for them, and why they should choose you over the alternatives.
Right, right. Well, let's jump ahead to, I think this is page 137, where you write, all paths eventually lead customers to your product narrative. Again, please explain what a product narrative is, as you explained very clearly, and what are some of the ingredients?
Yes, I love this concept of a product narrative, which is really the story you're telling your ideal customer about your product, starting with what's the problem we're solving, and then what's the big outcome we promise, then what are the big benefits of using our product, the value propositions, and then maybe most importantly, backing up those messages with a range of proof points that are really credibility building and motivating to your ideal customer. And when you think about a website or you think about a sales pitch deck, really successful ones are almost always going in this sequential order where there's this problem definition and empathy at the beginning. And then you pivot to, and we have the solution. This mm-hmm. is what it is. And then here are the reasons to choose us. And then here's all the proof that really should resonate with you about why our product is different and better. And so the culmination of the three P's in creating this product messaging is starting to think about, okay, how can we flow this through customer-facing touch points, including website, sales pitch, other content we're creating. And that's where coming up with a strong product narrative gives you really the summary of what you need to put in those touch points.
Right. And it's 8 steps. It's all on one page right here. Folks, you don't need a PhD in marketing to understand this. And the other thing you mentioned is proof points, which I skipped over there. But that's like functionality, social proof, you know, data. And then so the listener knows, you explain when to use which and when not to. So I'm going to jump ahead to page 167, I think, for those playing the home game. You write that while a startup's first marketer is likely responsible for many elements of your marketing strategy, they tend to skew towards one of two roles, a product marketer or a demand generation marketer. Explain what the difference is there and when one is maybe better suited than the other. Because my hunch is that a lot of people think of marketer is like a commodity, like a product, you know, just to get a marketer. There's a little more to it than that.
There is. And I like to think about marketing in three main functions. One is growth. What are you doing to attract new customers and drive more conversion? The second is product marketing, which is about how do you really do the work in this book? So how do you position and message your product? And then how do you engage your customer base? And the third is content. And that's a pretty general bucket for a lot of content creating and distribution functions, including social media, PR, etc. So when you think about an early stage startup, the founder, whether they realize it or not, is often wearing the hat of head of sales and head of product marketing, because mm-hmm. they are having to do this work to pitch their product and figure out how to describe it effectively. And when a company's deciding to hire their first marketer, oftentimes they're either feeling like, okay, our messaging, we have a general story about the product, our website's in okay shape. What we really need is to start to generate more leads and bring in more prospects. And that's where a growth marketer or a demand gen marketer tends to be a great fit, because they are more performance marketing oriented. They think about the range of channels they could use to attract, nurture, and convert customers. And they tend to be very data centric and cost conscious. So mm-hmm. how can we optimize and continue to bring down the cost of generating these leads? Whereas a product marketer is often partnering with the product team on what's the roadmap? What are the unmet needs of our customers? And what should we prioritize building next based on what the sales team is recommending and what we're hearing from customers? Then how can we help sales and the growth team tell the story of our product more effectively? And then product marketing often wears the hat of customer marketing too. So mm-hmm. how can we use marketing channels and content to onboard our customers more effectively or retain? And so what I see is that companies often are hiring one of those two roles first, and then their second hire is often the other one to balance it out. And then they're filling in content creation and design for some period of time with freelancers or agencies until they're ready to build out more of a full function, full stack marketing team.
Well, from where I sit, it seems like if you're just starting out, you need a product marketer before you need a demand gen person.
So I agree with you that you need to do product marketing before you start demand gen and growth activities. And this is where startups get into trouble. They start running paid ads and they start doing a lot of things to attract in customers and prospects. But A, they don't really know who they're trying to attract in. They haven't gotten clear on that. And B, their messaging's all over the map. So their sales team's saying one thing, they're saying something else, and it can feel very confusing to customers. Or just flat, right? Like, okay, I still don't really understand what your product does or why I should choose you over the alternatives. Mm-hmm. You know, thanks for wasting my time.
Yeah.
But part of why I wrote this book is founders are very well positioned to be the first product marketer. Mm-hmm. They have that deep customer empathy that helped them define the product to begin with. They're often in sales conversations. So if they're not doing product marketing, someone needs to do that first. But hiring a full-time product marketer isn't always the best first step for an early-stage startup.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to tell all your venture capital friends in San Francisco how to do their business. But what would happen if when people are in there asking for money, a lot of money. What if they were to have bought your book, read it, printed out all the stuff from the toolkit and worked through everything and then stapled the results to their pitch? Would they be more likely to get money? I mean, it just seems like there's an awful lot of money wasted based on a number of the things in your book that aren't done or glossed over.
I completely agree. Yes, I think VCs and I've seen boards smile ear to ear when companies come in with clarity on this is who we're targeting, this is how we're really differentiated, this is our brand personality, and these are our messages. And in the second part of the, or third part of the book, as I get into this customer journey dashboard, sometimes just the simplest view of where are we doing really well in the business and where is there friction along the customer journey can really help open your investors' eyes and your board's eyes to where should we prioritize content creation and channel efforts to make more progress in the business. But yes, it's really foundational. And I would love for more startups to have these tools so that investors get it and also so that they can attract their customers more effectively.
Right. Well, so the third part of the book is about creating a content strategy that drives growth. And I'm just curious, do you get much pushback or is there a lack of understanding from startup founders about why they even need to create content? I mean, do you get pushback about content? We don't need that. We can just go run ads.
What I get is a feeling of overwhelm. Like, we know we need to create content, but how the heck am I going to do that? I don't have a marketing team yet. Or even if I do, there are so many channels and things that I need to fuel. Like, where do I even start? Or there's this feeling of there's so much noise out there. Is this even worth it? Like, how am I going to cut through? And so many times founders will be thinking channel first about their content strategy. Like, I really wish I had a PR strategy, but I don't know where to start. Or I know I could be doing more on XYZ social media channel. How do I do that? But they're not thinking about what content do my customers need and where in the customer journey will that be helpful. And I think once they start thinking about it that way, they can narrow in on what's most important much more quickly.
Yes, and it's almost like you should write a chapter titled Prioritize Content to Fuel the Customer Journey. I'm kidding. That's chapter 14. And in there, I mean, this won't come as a surprise to some folks, but you show that there's you can break it down into five phases for the customer journey, okay? Now, the best model is the one that you use. Somebody could argue there should be four, it should be six. The secret to get ahead is getting started. So you've got attract, which is where you create awareness and capture the attention of your target customers. Nurture, where you build trust and desire for your solution, generating qualified leads. Then convert, and that's where you increase the confidence that your product is the right choice, driving sales or signups. And then the last two are very, very interesting. And even non-tech companies should be doing this. But the fourth one is onboard. Accelerate new users' time to value so they get results, increasing new user retention, and engage is the fifth one. Ensure active users continue to get value, keep using, and renew, increasing retention. Of course, there's been books on the show that have been just about marketing to your customers. And these aren't for tech companies. In other words, that's where the money is. They already know you. They like you. They want to buy more from you. But once they get the first purchase, the company kind of ignores them and they have very leaky buckets, you could say. But of those five, are attract, nurture, convert, onboard, engage, are any of them more problematic or a struggle for startups?
A couple of them are more overlooked than others. And I'll say the onboard stage is so critical, but often one that is fully left to product. And it's phenomenal if the product offers a great onboarding experience. But there are so many channels and types of ways of reaching customers that marketing owns that product isn't necessarily focused on that can really help with onboarding, including things like email sequences that walk a new user step by step through what to do, or even community where other users are supporting new users in adopting best practices and getting to value quickly. It's so disheartening for a startup or a company to really improve their acquisition funnel or their sales process and to find that customers are dropping out just weeks after they join or they're not renewing after the third month. And so I do think this sometimes gets neglected. And this is another goal of the book, to really give founders and non-marketers a view of the full set of things that marketing can be thinking about. And don't just think about marketing as acquisition, which can be a bias. Really think about it as the full customer lifecycle, including onboarding engagement. So that's a key one.
The money is in the customers that you keep, particularly in your world of subscription marketing, as they call it. So let's jump ahead to a couple other things that I found interesting. And also, this may help with the overwhelm. And that's where, let's see, this is on page 193, where the chapter on creating a core content plan, which I think might make it easier for folks. You write, focusing your audience's attention on core content also helps your startup create a surround sound of cohesive messages that all stem from the same few pieces. This smart strategy streamlines your content creation process and helps you achieve your goals with less content. Allison, you had me at less content. Explain, if you would, what is a core content plan as you outline in your book?
Yes. So the big shift here is really moving away from thinking about channel by channel content creation to, as I look over the next quarter, what are the big things that I need to communicate with my customers, either because it's really important in the life cycle of their business, like it's peak season, and so they're really thinking about these particular issues, or would be more open to hearing about why they should use these features in our product, or because we're releasing something, a product update or something else, and we need to share that information with them. So really thinking about what are the key messages I need to get across and what content could be very timely and relevant to share that. And let's focus on creating a few higher quality pieces of content, whether it's in a written format like a report or a blog or video or audio, and then thinking about how to adapt that to each stage of the customer lifecycle and share that through our channels. And another important part of core content strategy is you need to think about parallel pathing evergreen content and timely content. So I really encourage startup leaders to start with creating this happy path of content that moves someone from discovering your company and your product exists through nurturing them and helping them understand the great outcomes your product delivers, the differentiators, and convert. And that can often be more evergreen content. It's the assets that will live for a long time that your sales team will be using. It's your website that you don't want to be changing every week. So put evergreen core content on your roadmap, but also choose some of the most important timely topics you can be talking about and work that into your core content roadmap as well, so that you're really engaging customers and piquing their interest around a topic that's really important to them at that moment.
Yes, folks, you don't have to play the content arms race. You don't need more content. You need more helpful content. And I love the term you use, happy path nurture content.
Yes.
It made me happy just reading it. Well, I want to jump ahead, though. Again, we've already started to touch on this. It's from chapter 17. And you write about the channels you should use to reach your ideal customers, and that it is important and imperative that you go in this specific order. And I'm going to read what they are. Owned, which is channels that your company controls, like your website, emails, your blog. Earned, channels that voluntarily mention or share your content, PR, SEO, podcasts. Social media channels you use to engage your audience, like LinkedIn. Paid, channels where you pay for placement, like digital ads, events, partnerships. Do you find that startups tend not to want to go in that order, or what? What's the natural impulse? Because you make it, fortunately, so clear that you need to go in this order.
Yes. So for many startups, the natural impulse is let's get a website up and then let's go straight to paid channels because we feel like we can control how we get in front of our prospects. And sometimes gaining customers and getting in front of other audiences through earned channels is a bit of a long game, or it can take more time. But going back to your question earlier about a phase of the life of the customer journey that's sometimes neglected, really making sure that once you have the attention of your ideal customer, you have content and experiences that will help them get up to speed on your product and understand why to choose you and then convert is so critical. And that typically happens in the owned channels, your website, your emails, potentially your blog or other places where you have content. And you want to really optimize those first before you bring in any new leads in the top of the funnel. And I think many companies don't understand earned media or earned channels enough. They're so incredible because they're free. I put in quotation marks because, of course, you need people and content resources to fuel them. But whether it's playing the long game and building an SEO strategy so you're ranking organically for content that customers or prospects are searching for, or you're getting in front of other people's audiences where a podcast host has credibility with a large group, and suddenly you can talk about your product in front of a bunch of ideal customers that you didn't have to pay for and that you didn't have to spend months building up on your own. Those are so valuable, and I really help a lot of startups think through how to create that earned strategy before they ever go to paid channels.
Mm-hmm. Real quickly, can you tell us what product-led growth is, PLG? That was interesting, and I didn't know quite as much about that.
Yes, product-led growth is a very important concept, especially in tech companies and that have platforms. And really, it takes a few different flavors. So one is where the product is able to spread the word about itself through other people experiencing the product. Like I give the example of an accounting software company where the invoice says powered by the company name. And so other businesses that receive those invoices might be intrigued and click through. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to pay anything for that marketing. It's embedded in a touch point that many of your ideal customers are going to see over time. Network effects are another type of product-led growth where I get more benefit out of the product by bringing in other new users. And so I'm naturally just spreading the word and helping really scale the user base over time. And then another type of product-led growth is virality and referrals. So how can your product experience be so great that your customers can't wait to rave about it to their peers or other people? And so again, just by providing a really effective product experience and strong outcomes for your customers, they're starting to do the marketing for you.
Yeah, Dropbox comes to mind. That was product-led growth, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I interviewed Sean Ellis about his book, Hacking Growth, a few years back. It was really, he was one of the folks at Dropbox. And I'll include a link to that interview as well as some of the others on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. The last thing I want to ask you about is customer marketing. And this is the, as I mentioned, the marketing that subscription marketers understand better than most, but it's largely ignored or severely deprioritized by most businesses, and I don't know, maybe tech companies as well. And the different types of customer marketing that startups should be doing, I want to mention, they are on page 236 here. And we've talked about the first one, which is onboarding content, very important, but you said a lot of people skip this part, or they hand it off to someone else after they've got the customer signed up. And the other three are lifecycle marketing, feature launches, and seasonal campaigns. It's just, these seem like things that are such a great opportunity because you're not having to build as much awareness. These are people that already like you, and they might find this very helpful. Can you talk about those three, lifecycle, feature launches, and seasonal campaigns?
Yes. Well, back on the point of product-led growth, really one of the best forms of marketing is your product delivering outstanding results for your customers and having an excellent user experience so that your customers want to tell others. And
do a lot of firms forget about that part?
Well, it's surprising. I think sometimes companies want to create messaging that actually doesn't align with the results that they deliver. And that gets really tricky too. And that does create tension between marketing and product. Sometimes product wants marketing to say something about their product that they can't deliver. And so this also speaks to just the cross-functional nature of a messaging and positioning exercise. Mm-hmm. You really have to make sure that the product is delivering what you say it can, that the sales team understands that as well. Otherwise, this gets very confusing for the customer.
You're being very diplomatic. Thank you.
Thank you. But lifecycle marketing, where there are contextual tips or triggered emails and messages that really nudge a customer to take the next step and do something that will provide value, is a great first step in customer marketing. Mm-hmm. So without a marketing team have to do anything, messages are being sent and customers are experiencing content and nudges that really encourage them to do smart, useful things in the product.
Right. Like, so, let's get the rest of your profile set up, or, you know, let's work through a, you know, sort of a grid here.
That's exactly right. And many times, just encouraging someone to take the next step can really help them get more out of the product and become a more active user. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The second thing is feature launches. So you're launching new product features for a reason. Ideally, this is either delivering even bigger benefits that you're already promising, but now you can do it even better, or it's opening up a new way of providing value to your customers. And so anytime you've got interesting, useful new functionality that you're rolling out, you really want to make sure customers understand that that's there and they should be using that. I'll also say this sometimes cuts the other way. Sometimes you're making changes that are controversial or painful, whether it's a price increase or sunsetting a certain feature. And so being really proactive with your customers, helping them understand, you understand their needs, this is why you made this decision, and this is how they can make it work, can be very important in retaining customers.
Yeah, and I would think that a customer, one of the ideal responses might be, wow, thank you. I would have never thought to have asked for that. That's really cool. I like you guys.
Yes, absolutely. And again, you're connecting the messaging of the feature launch back to what do you know about what this customer values, the big outcomes they want in their business. And if you have a strong messaging framework, oftentimes the new features you're releasing over the next year are just helping you double down on those benefits that you were already promising. So it's helping you tell an even stronger story to your customers. So that is very helpful. And then the third thing that I mentioned that I think is often overlooked and underutilized by companies is seasonal campaigns. And so sometimes these are tied to product launches, but sometimes this is just tied to, for instance, at Handshake, this is peak recruiting season. Our recruiters are really interested in tips about how to get in front of college students and make them more interested in our company and interview best practices and other things that can help us land the best candidates. And students on the platform were particularly interested in the fall of each year in what can I do to stand out to employers and how can I figure out what jobs are right for me. So without changing anything in your product, you can run a campaign that draws attention to your best features and tips to drive higher engagement in that time of the year with things that are really important to your customers at that time too.
Mm. Yes. Well, it seems like the first question is there any seasonality to your business? And they'll say, yes. Say, okay, well.
Plan your content around that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, what's the nature of it? Okay, God, I hadn't thought of that. So, well, Allison, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Nailing your product messaging is so critical to get traction with your ideal customers and drive user and revenue growth. And to create effective messaging, you need to build the foundation first. You need to understand your three P's, which are who is your persona, who are you talking to and what do they value, what is your positioning, what differentiates you and makes you different and better for that ideal customer, and then what's your personality? How do you show up and communicate consistently and visually in a way that really builds affinity with your ideal customer? And once you know those things and have effective messaging, you are in a very good position to create an effective channel and content strategy, which is the crux of marketing. So hopefully this book gives a really strong step-by-step process to nail down creating an effective content strategy, marketing strategy that attracts, converts, and retains customers.
Can you dig it?
Extremely well said. So what is one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book to get them thinking in the right direction?
I'd encourage you to do two quick dashboards just to see where you need to focus your attention, because resources are lean. You've got to move fast. I know that. So the first dashboard I'd create is really just write down persona, positioning, personality, messaging, and give yourself a red, yellow, green. How clear are you in each of those areas? Where it's green, great. Where it's red, I would really prioritize improving that over the next quarter so that you can be in a stronger position with your marketing strategy. And then the second dashboard is create that customer journey dashboard. So attract, nurture, convert, onboard, engage. Again, give each one a red, yellow, green based on how effectively are you meeting your goals in each of those areas. And where is there friction for your customers? Where do you know you could drive more growth if you had better content or a better channel strategy? And then allocate your resources to the areas that are falling behind. And I think doing those two things will really help focus your efforts in the right areas.
Oh, great advice. Great advice. And I think when it's red, that could also, like, we're talking about the different types of content for the customer journey, and you've got onboard and engage, and you're not doing any. Would that be where it would be red, Allison Letary?
Yes, exactly. Where you're not doing anything, or where you know customers are not converting at a rate that they should be,
yeah.
Or you're paying way too much for leads, and so something is not working in that area of your marketing strategy. And again, this is such a simple dashboard, but it is very eye-opening for investors, your board, and your whole company, because suddenly you can see where could marketing actually help us drive growth, and let's focus our efforts there.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Where could marketing help us drive growth? It can't do everything, folks. The marketers don't know all the winning lottery ticket numbers. They don't have magic pixie dust. So, Allison, looking back, what books have most inspired your working career?
I love Building a Story Brand by Donald Miller.
Oh, yeah.
Such a classic. Mm-hmm. And it gives such a clear overview of this idea of your customer is the hero of the story. You are taking them from an undesirable starting point to a really wonderful end state, and you are the guide that is taking them on this journey. And so I would really encourage people who are working through messaging to reference that book as well. And then I do want to mention Fascinate by Sally Hogshead, which I mention in the book.
And oh, yeah.
This book, her book, is what are the 7 fascination triggers that draw people in and make them want to consume information and content. And once you know the types of topics you need to create content on, you'll find that having a really juicy hook, something that makes me stop the scroll, makes me die, you know, really want to understand the answer or the outcome of this headline, is really critical in driving engagement with your content. And I was searching for a framework, you know, what is the best way to think about the different types of hooks you could create? And I adapt it to captivating content hooks in my book, but I really love the way she talks about the 7 fascination triggers.
Well, Allison Letary, you don't just mention that and get away from it. Okay, now this is something I didn't ask about, but it was on page 206, and this is where you mentioned her book, Fascinate, and she describes 7 powerful fascination triggers: lust, mystique, alarm, prestige, power, vice, and trust, that motivate people to pay attention and take action. And then what Allison has done is adapted these into a framework of 7 captivating content hooks, and these these work just way too well. Yours are pleasure, secrets, security, status, control, freedom, and reliability. Oh, thank you for letting me shoehorn that in there. That was very, I liked that very much as well. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading?
I am excited to read Sales Pitch by April Dunford.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Her first book, Obviously Awesome, is such a great overview of how to create strong positioning if you are a B2B company, thinking about how to define your category and how to stand out within that category. But what I've heard from some of the things, some of the podcasts and other things I've listened to April talk about with Sales Pitch is she also really believes in helping your ideal customers understand the criteria they should be using to evaluate products in your category. Mm-hmm. And I've found through my own positioning work that really choosing and identifying the attributes that your product is very strong in is critical. So I'm excited to read that and see more about how she describes that process.
Oh, yeah. And that book has been mentioned a few times on the podcast. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including the books that you've mentioned and books that I've mentioned in terms of interviews that have been on the show, your website, your LinkedIn profile. And now a word to you, dear listener, please reach out to Allison in some way and thank her for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Congratulate her on this excellent, excellent book. And if nothing else, share this interview on LinkedIn if you liked it and tag us so we can thank you. Guests on the show love hearing and interacting with Marketing Book Podcast listeners. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Final quote, page 10. This book gives you the tools and guidance you need to make your startup stand out. I wrote Startup Stand Out to speed up success for startup founders and teams who work tirelessly to scale world-changing products. My goal is to make it easier for you to impact the lives of customers who need you the most. The book is Stand Out Startup, the Founder's Guide to Irresistible Marketing that Fuels Growth. The author is Allison Letary. Allison, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much, Douglas.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. To make sure you never miss an episode, you have a few options. The best way is subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, or go to marketingbookpodcast.com and sign up for email notifications, or on LinkedIn, find the Marketing Book Podcast page and click the subscribe button and maybe meet some of your fellow listeners. If you are among the many listeners who have left a review on Apple Podcasts or have promoted the show to others, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."